this morning's papers, and from AM until Monday, when we'll be back at the usual time. You're with ABC Radio. It's 8:30.
And on 3LO, on this December the 16th, 1983, which you may or may not know is Beethoven's 213th birthday.
He's still in good shape.
You're listening to The Ultimate Melbourne This Morning with Terry Lane.
And Alan Stokes. Melbourne's weather. Fine morning cloud clearing to a cool to mild and sunny day. A moderate west to southwesterly wind tending southerly during the afternoon. And an estimated high of 22 degrees.
In a moment, the absolute high points of the last 12 months of broadcasting. Some advice on what you might consider giving for Christmas in the way of books and other things. And some things to do over the holidays, because we only have a short program.
We certainly do. We'll be crossing to Parliament in 9:02 this morning, and in that time we'll also be indulging ourselves with some of our favourite music.
3LO, Melbourne This Morning with Terry Lane and Alan Stokes.
Looking back over the year to the interviews that have been done on this program, and looking for the most outstanding interview, the one that made the greatest impression, the one that evoked the most response, the one that received the most applause, there is absolutely no doubt which one it was. There was one interview which stood
head and shoulders.
I was going to say feet and knees.
Above the rest.
Above all other interviews. It was the one that Alan did with Reg Mellor of Barnsley in Yorkshire, who indulges himself in the most unusual pastime.
Mr. Mellor, what gave you the idea of sticking ferrets down your trousers in the first place?
Well, I used to go out with my father, and we used to get we used to wear oilskins on his legs, you know.
Right.
And we'd go in the long bramble and grass and bracken, and his coat used to get wet through. And we'd perish in these little money bags, so they used to get wet. So my father says, right, we'll put them down as trousers. And I started putting them down without the bag. And I tried to do. And I got used to it, and I've carried on ever since.
Now, what about the ferrets? What do they think of being stuck down your trousers?
Well, the ferrets, it doesn't make any difference to them, because a ferret, my way of looking at it, a ferret is a born killer. You can teach a ferret to, they'll bite your hand, you see, but you can teach them not to bite your hand, the hand that feeds them. But once you put them in the dark, they will tackle anything. It's a born killer. It's either kill or be killed yourself.
Now, the trouble is, of course, if you stick a ferret down your trousers, then he is in the dark and he's likely to attack anything that's down there.
Anything that, yes. He'll bite at anything that moves. Anything with a odor on it, which is your lower part of your body.
Now, have you ever been attacked by the ferrets in your trousers?
Oh, yes. I've just done a film for the German television. And you just simply stand there and eat and you're alive. I broke the world record.
How long did you manage to keep them down, your trousers?
How long?
Yes.
I broke the world record at the Pennine Show in front of 2,500 people and 4 independent witnesses, expecting to go in the Guinness Book of Records. I had them down 5 hours and 26 minutes.
Oh, and what sort of state were you in after the 5 hours and 25 minutes?
And I was just like a slaughterhouse. People said it's a shame. Go to the doctor. I never go to the doctor. I just go home and get into a Dettol bath, you see.
Right.
And give myself a good bath with Dettol in.
And you're all right again.
Oh, penicillin, and I'm all right.
Yes. Are there many other people who follow the sport in Britain?
They go out rabbiting with ferrets, but they will not put them down the trousers.
Well, I think that you'd have to agree that of all the interviews that were conducted on the program during the year, that would be the most memorable. We probably should have warned people. I mean, it's something that people should record, I think, and keep forever.
Well, Gordon Lewis has made a request to play it again one day next week on the show that's not going to be Melbourne This Morning. I don't know what it's being called, but next Wednesday.
Just Alan Stokes filling in.
That's right. So we might play it again, or a little bit of it again, next Wednesday morning. Of course, there's been an amazing diversity of people have come on the program during the year. We've had politicians, we've had actors, we've had all sorts of people involved in community action, and of course we've had a wealth of authors. We've probably had more authors on this program than any other show over the course of 5 years, let alone 1 year. And of course, one of the things that Terry's noted for is always reading the books that he's interviewing people about. But this isn't always to the author's advantage, as this exchange between Terry and author William Davis, who is here to publicise his book called The Rich, illustrates. One of the chapters was about Kerry Packer.
The reason why I asked how you researched it was because I had the spooky experience, because I did read the book, as you observed before, of coming to a section in the book which is lifted verbatim out of one of my books.
Oh, no. Yes. I don't believe it.
Well, it's
come
true.
Come on. I've never read any of your books.
perhaps you haven't, but all that section there attributed to Kerry Packer is in fact an extract from my book, As the Twig is Bent.
Well, no. Kerry Packer wrote himself. There was a book of childhood memories.
That's right.
And Kerry Packer wrote that.
No, I interviewed him.
Well, that's strange, because the book certainly isn't presented at that way. Kerry Packer is an old friend of mine. I've interviewed him many times. I stayed with him at his house at Christmas, and most of the story I tell about Kerry Packer are stories that have never been printed before. And in fact, I had to be rather careful, because there are a lot more stories I could have printed. But that particular one was sent to me by his office as his own childhood recollections. And indeed, they are not a quote from your book. It's a quote directly from Kerry Packer. But if it's included in a book you've written, well done. I'm glad you wrote it first. But believe me, I have not seen your book at all.
Well, they must have sent you a photocopy of this, because...
May I have a look at it?
Yes. If you start... he wasn't a family man. I mean, there's a lot more as well.
Childhood Recollections of 16 Prominent Australians. I have not seen the book. I was sent this page.
Well, I decided to take the matter up with the Copyright Council of Australia, but I think that they looked at all the potential protagonists in this case and decided that they weren't going to take on Kerry Packer, and they weren't going to take on William Davis. They'd just tell old, what's this fellow's name here, Lane, to get lost, because they wrote back and said that even though I had recorded the interview, I had transcribed it, Valda had typed it and done the impeccable punctuation of the interview, I had no copyright rights. I don't know whether you have copyright rights or just copyright interest.
Copyright.
I had no copyright interest in the material that I'd included in my own book.
That's ridiculous.
So anybody listening can now consider that As the Twig is Bent is open slather for plagiarists all over the world.
But it would seem to me that would apply to most newspaper items too, where people are interviewed and they're quoted. Obviously, that's not copyright material either.
Well, it probably applies to anything that happens on the ABC, anything that's reported in newspapers. You can use it how you like. Anyway,
very strange. Very strange.
As I said, you're listening to The Ultimate Melbourne This Morning. The time is 22 and a half minutes to 9 on 3LO, and we have a friend on the line.
Well, there have been a lot of people who've been associated with the program over the course of its production, and we'd like to pay our tribute to the support they've given us over the time and the part they've played in putting the program to air. We've had a couple of producers. We've had John Beeston and Brian Hugo. We've had wonderful research assistants from Jill Kitson and from assistant producers Debbie Richards and Maggie Dalmeyer, and also Helen Richardson. We've had production assistants from Della Hilton, who's done the most important job of the lot, and that is make the cup of tea in the morning, which keeps us going. And also production assistants from Murdo McLeod, Sarah Mogridge, and Gary Bartholomew. But there's one person who I think has been more closely associated with the program than any other, and helped to get it off the ground in the first place. And he, unfortunately, has left us. He's no longer with us, but he's on the line to us now from Sydney.
John Beeston, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
And how is it being the executive producer of PM?
Oh, well, it's certainly very different. Instead of having to drag myself out of bed at 5:30 in the morning, we keep gentlemen's hours, and I don't have to actually get into the office until about 10 o'clock, which is a very nice change after 5 years of getting up early.
Well, Alan and I are both looking forward to the late rising next year, because Alan, what time you'll be starting at?
I'll be starting at ABC Melbourne Gentlemen's Hours, and that's 10 o'clock in the morning, and going through until 12 o'clock. And it won't be the same as a mid morning show. It'll be a human interest show, but our regulars, the ones that we had on this year, Hugh Worth and Gordon Lewis and Dr. Paul and so, will be back with us. So it's 10 o'clock until 12 o'clock.
And I'll be starting at 10 past 1. And at this stage, I think that my programme will run from 10 past 1 till 2 o'clock, but that has yet to be finally settled. John...
You might have a few surprises for you there.
You might have a few surprises.
But, yes, I hear you've been doing the best of the programme this morning. That must have been very difficult for you to choose. Have you been playing any of my interviews when I had to stand in for Alan?
No.
I remember Lost Trios Ring Barkers. I remember it very clearly, actually, as you probably would too. But
it did very well.
Yeah.
Look, just one question before we say Merry Christmas to each other. How long have you worked, or how long did you work on the 3LO morning programme? How many presenters did you work with before you went to PM?
Well, I started originally with Elizabeth Bond, and then I was with her for about a year, and then after that, Andrew Potter was there, and I at some stage worked with Sam Lipsky too, when he stood in for Elizabeth Bond for a few months. And then briefly with Paula Nagel, and then, of course, yourself and Alan, and there's been a couple of other odd people who have been there for a few months over the years.
A couple of other odd people.
You can't talk about Muriel like that.
Well, I think that makes you the great survivor, but it also makes Alan and I the great destroyers, because we were able to get rid of you.
Yes, but, well, I've got a very thick hide. But rather sadly, I've come up here to Sydney to do PM and have only had the opportunity to work with Hugh Evans for his last few months. Hugh, of course, is leaving PM and going on to do a television series next year, and I believe Alan's talking to him next week. And Paul Murphy from Nationwide will be taking over as the compere, so I will be looking forward to working with Paul.
Well, John Beeston, thanks very much for calling us, and have a nice Christmas.
And all the best, and enjoy the party today.
What party?
About a dozen run to a party.
On the last Melbourne this morning, the time is 18 and a half minutes to 9. We've chosen some of our favourite music for this morning. And what does that mean?
Tell me what it is.
Tell you what it is. Have you got the Deadwood stage? You've got the Deadwood stage lined up. Alan and I were each given permission to indulge ourselves and to choose some music which we consider to be classic, and as over the past few days I've been talking to Peter Evans about Calamity Jane and the fact that every song from Calamity Jane was a hit in the year in which the film was released, and my favourite of them all is the Deadwood stage.
Oh, the Deadwood stage is rolling on over the plains, with the curtains flapping and the driver a-slapping the reins. A beautiful sky, a wonderful day. Whip, crack away, whip, crack away, whip, crack away. Oh, the Deadwood stage is heading on over the hills, where the engine arrows are thicker than porcupine quills. Dangerous land, no time to delay. So whip, crack away, whip, crack away, whip, crack away. We're heading straight for town, loaded down with the fancy cargo, care of Wells and Fargo, Illinois. Boy, oh, the Deadwood stage is coming on over the crest.
And that, of course, is Terry's choice for the music that he has most enjoyed on the programme.
The lovely Doris Day.
And he claims that's a classic, and he disputes the fact that my choice is a classic, but I don't think there's any doubt about it whatsoever. Here's Carly Simon.
Hide from your love.
Now, this is something that's never happened on Melbourne This Morning before, but being the last program, we've managed to inveagle a passerby into the studio.
What are these?
They keep your ears warm. You see, they're electric earmuffs.
There's an echo. Hang on, nothing's happening to mine.
No, it's all right, it's all right. Don't you worry about it. I'll give you a little bit of extra.
Haven't you ever seen Malcolm before?
Oh, is that Malcolm?
It's Malcolm.
Oh,
it's the talking clock.
You can play with that if you like, Peter.
Well, now, Terry, what are you going to do on my program this morning? I'm practicing for next year.
It's very nice to have you. We haven't got enough time. Something's going to have to go on this program.
No. I don't want to stay.
No, you came to tell
I've
us about
it. I've got ice cream melting in the back of my car.
What, the Eskimo pies?
Yeah.
And the
ones that are supposed to go to the unit, which
I've
And
the ice cream cake.
Liz says, why doesn't he divide them round? Little do the people know that all the things that I'm presented in this place go to the widows and orphans. Mm. I don't use them. I don't use them myself.
You're not an orphan yourself.
But there's a Mrs. Evans. There's two Mrs. Evanses. There's all the orphans.
I think any little boy whose father disappeared up the Amazon qualifies as an orphan.
Yes. That's what I've always said to mine. Look, this is terribly embarrassing. I have nothing prepared, as we usually have, everything written down.
Yes, it's a script, yeah.
People will now ring up and say, do they really have a script?
We've already gone through this business of trying to say goodbye once this morning. Yeah, we don't want to do it again.
I was going to ask the... Oh, sorry, no, I'll get out of your way. But anyone who wants Evans to take over the morning show from Lane, I mean, I'd be subservient to you. I'd be under you. I'd be second. I'm quite willing to play the minor role. I mean, we could get rid of that fella.
You're qualified to do that.
Yes, I'm qualified to play the thingy-bobs. Yeah. And we get rid of all that lot out there. I mean, the unit's going to move to the 19th floor of St. James anyway. Didn't you know that?
I heard you say.
Yes, it's an excellent place for them.
You know what? I think we just missed out on John Alsop. But
We haven't got time. Have we got time for John Alsop?
Yes. Right. Yeah. I'll get off. Don't want me. I'm going. They don't want me. I'm going to sulk.
Thanks, Peter.
John Alsop has been a regular contributor to the program every Monday during the year, and here he is with his overview of the year of gloom and doom. Not as good as ever.
In the final analysis, which is, of course, the last analysis before the grand final analysis, in which the winners of the first semi-final analysis play off against the final semi-final finalist analysts, where was I? Oh, yes. In the final analysis, it's extremely difficult to say whether 1983 will be remembered as the year of living dangerously, the year of dying gangrenously, or the year of mining strenuously. In fact, it's difficult to say if 1983 will be remembered at all, if the Falklands, Lebanon, Syria, Grenada, and so on have been any kind of prelude to a more embracingly global conflict. On the domestic scene, the year got off to a pretty hilarious start with the election of a new federal government and a new prime minister with a terrific sense of humour, as illustrated by the way he constantly likens himself to Sir Robert Menzies. His first major act in office was to convene a national economic summit, at which all kinds of people, normally devoted to carving each other up, agreed not just on one or two points, but on everything. This mood of agreement was a complete mystery to everyone not in attendance at the summit, until several months later when the grog bill turned up. In any case, the conference produced policies which really got things going for a while there, and it was full steam ahead towards 750,000 unemployed, until as many as 4 or 5 people actually found jobs, and this was hailed as an economic turnaround. At the same time, Australians young and old excelled in sport, winning apparently everything to the point where next year's Olympics are shaping up to be a pretty one-sided affair. Our America's Cup win prompted wave upon wave of national celebration, involving, to my knowledge, only one death in festive Lygon Street.
I know that charm and manners count, but I like what you do. Put it there, pal. Put it there. No matter what my lawyer says, I've always liked you too. Put it there, pal. Put it there. My colleague.
My crony.
My cohort.
My friend.
My second sacker.
My third base coach.
Chums to the end.
Like meat and potatoes.
You better lay off potatoes.
Boy, what a blend. Don't put it in the paper. Don't put it on the air.
I'll finish. Don't
put it on. And with a tear in our eyes, we say goodbye. As the program sinks slowly into the west, we now present the final story in our series of 7 short stories by Saki called The Bull.
Thank you. Tom Yorkfield had always regarded his half-brother, Lawrence, with a lazy instinct of dislike, toned down, as years went on, to a tolerant feeling of indifference.